Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thank you for joining us. I just spoke with John Osberg about his new book, Anxious Wealth, Money and Morality Among China's New Rich. This was published with Stanford University Press in 2013. The book is centered on Chengdu, and it uses a series of case studies in this very local circumstance to make claims, to make arguments, and to really inform how we understand the emergence of new forms of masculinity and also forms of business relationships, really ultimately forms of personhood in contemporary China. I won't go into too much detail now about the nature of the arguments of the book and the contents of the book, because you'll get that in the rather extensive interview that's to follow. But I will say that one of the really exciting things about the book is that each case study, each chapter really, not only introduces a cast of really interesting actors into this story, but also takes at its heart either an implicit or explicit contradiction that really helps readers rethink some of the phenomena that we take for granted, some of the concepts that we take for granted, not only in the way that we understand China today, but also in the way we understand, I think, what it is to be a human being in a society. He's very careful not to make these claims about, you know, speaking about human nature as a whole. But I think one of the things that we can get out of this, and that I certainly got out of this as a reader, is a way of rethinking some basic conceptual categories that I had certainly taken for granted before, not only in the way that I understood China, but beyond. So it's a very interesting book. It's a very well-written book. It's a very lively set of case studies that he's presented us with. And it was great to talk with John about it. He's got a lot of really interesting stories also, you'll hear in the course of the conversation, to add to the accounts in the book. And so it's really fascinating to hear him talk about it. I hope you enjoy. We're here today to talk with John Osberg about his new book, Anxious Wealth, Money and Morality Among China's New Rich. Welcome to the channel of New Books in East Asian Studies, John, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with me.
Thanks for having me.
So, John, could you start us off by just saying a little bit about what brought you into the field? How did you become interested in and start working on the anthropology of China?
Well, I was an anthropology major as an undergrad, and I sort of had a vague interest in East Asia at the time, but I hadn't done any formal Chinese language study. I'd taken a few courses related to China. But as a sort of bridge between undergrad and graduate school, I ended up teaching English in China for a year. And within a few weeks of being in China, I was certain that I wanted to come back and do my dissertation research in China. I ended up actually applying to graduate school from China, which was a bit of a challenge at the time because it was sort of before the internet was widely available in China. So I was, having to do a lot of correspondence by letter. But it worked out, and I ended up, at the time I felt like there was, and I still feel this way, that there was basically a research project around every corner in China. So,
now the book that we're talking about today looks at the rise of elite networks of what you call newly rich entrepreneurs, and we'll talk a little bit about that category and what it means to call, a group of people newly rich, and all of this is a really interesting part of the work you're doing in the book. But it looks at these networks of entrepreneurs, managers of state enterprises, and government officials, and it looks at these networks from the perspective of gendered formations, and it's really, really an interesting and very informative book that I think speaks to a lot of not just phenomena that were happening clearly in early 20th century China, but also phenomena that are very relevant to how we understand global geopolitics today. So it's a really interesting book. Now, you just mentioned teaching English in China, and at the very beginning of the introduction, you invoke a period in 1997 where you had just arrived to teach English to Chinese students in Guangzhou. Is that the same year you're talking about?
Yeah, it is.
Great. Now, you mention early in this book that it was conversations with your students that actually brought you to, ultimately, some of the concerns that you wind up exploring in the book. Is that how you came to this particular topic? Or if not, can you talk a little bit about how you came to focus on this particular subject?
Sure. Well, definitely my conversations with my students, I think, sort of planted the seeds of this project. I mean, coming to China as someone who was, you know, without much of a background in China studies at the time, I was, as many casual observers are, I was sort of interested in this, the kind of seeming paradox of a country still officially committed to communism, in which you had these dramatic inequalities and disparities in wealth. And I expected my students, or just ordinary Chinese people that I spoke with, to sort of be outraged by this as well. But what really struck me from the beginning is that that discussions about inequality were rarely framed in terms of wealth, but they were often framed in terms of morality. So I mentioned in the book, you know, my male students were really outraged that these, in their minds, sort of undeserving nouveau riche farmers, you know, were now attracting, you know, wives from the nearby town, that there were rumors of some of these nouveau riche businessmen having mistresses and, you know, second wives. And this was really what seemed to attract their attention more than just the disparity in wealth per se. So that kind of looking at the nexus, I'd say, of wealth, morality, and gender, I think that idea was sort of planted in my head through those conversations. And then the project sort of grew from there. I mean, a couple other things I think also inspired it. I mean, one was a desire to do field work in a big city that wasn't, you know, Beijing, Shanghai, or Guangzhou, where a lot of social science field work was being conducted at the time. Desire also, I think, to look at a group, you know, we have lots of fantastic studies of what we might call, you know, the new poor in China, you know, both, you know, studies of peasants, of migrant workers, of laid off factory workers. But the studies of elites, and in particular of new elites, have been relatively few. So I think that those were also kind of inspirations in the back of my mind to get away from the big cities and to try to do what anthropologists call studying up, you know, studying powerful groups rather than marginalized groups.
So how did you settle on Chengdu as a field site in the first place then?
Well, part of it was this desire to get out of, you know, get away from the East Coast. And in the late 90s, you know, the central government embarked on this sort of Develop the West campaign, which in some ways is still going on today. And so, you know, I had the idea that I could sort of see a process that had already been going on for a while in the east of China, sort of see that happening in Chengdu, as, you know, Chengdu was sort of a little bit, wasn't quite as far along in its economic rise as some of the coastal cities. But part of it was also definitely sort of non-intellectual and non-academic, in that I really liked the food in Chengdu, and the people seemed pretty friendly. And in retrospect, I honestly think that given the nature of my project and studying elites, I think it would have been really difficult for me to pull it off in a place like Beijing or Shanghai. I mean, it was going to being a Chinese-speaking foreigner, you know, in Chengdu in the, you know, right around in the early 2000s, I still stood out a bit, you know, and people were curious about me in a way that they certainly would have been, wouldn't have been curious about me, in a lot of the coastal cities. So, I mean, I even think today, if I tried to do it today in Chengdu, it might not be as successful because I would just be a dime a dozen of, you know, Chinese speaking foreigners. So,
So you mentioned that this did begin as graduate work and it began as a dissertation. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit before we get more in depth into the chapters of the book itself and some of this really fascinating ethnographic field work that you describe in the book? How did you move from the book as a dissertation to the book as a book? Were there any kind of major transformations along the way or any surprises or ways that the project substantially transformed from one format to the other?
Well, I received some, I guess, what turned out to be good advice, which was to write my dissertation like a book. And you know, from the very beginning, I had that advice in the back of my mind. So I think I wrote a very un-dissertation-like dissertation, at least you know, that's what some readers told me. You know, and I maybe I'm the first person in the history of academic publishing who published a dissertation and was told to put more of a literature review in rather than, you know, the most common, you know, comment is, you know, take out the lit review or pare it down or, you know, trim it a bit. And I actually needed to put a little bit more lit review in there. The biggest challenge actually moving from dissertation to book was just thinking, having to think and really make a lot of difficult choices about audience. You know, with dissertation, you ultimately, you know, you need to please an audience of, you know, 3 to 5 dissertation advisors, and that's what really matters. And the real difficulty I had in going from dissertation to book was now I've got, you know, not just an audience of a couple of people, but multiple audiences. You know, there's the sort of the China studies audience, the anthropology audience, and then perhaps given the sort of the nature of my topic, there might even be, you know, a broader just readership and who's just interested in China, who might stumble across my book and try, you know, and I sort of realized that certain revisions I made that were going to please one of those audiences were likely going to alienate the other. And so that was the real challenge. And I think what I ultimately decided on is, you know, I'm just going to write the book that I would want to read as, you know, an anthropologist and who's interested in China. And so that was the way that I kind of resolved the this sort of tendency, you know, wanting to try to prove, to try to please these very, in what in my mind were sort of often somewhat disparate audiences who are going to be interested in different aspects of the book.
One of the really fascinating things about the book that comes up right at the beginning, right in the introduction actually, is your discussion of the kinds of fieldwork that went into the project, both at the very early stages and in terms of the kind of relationships that you were able to build that eventually led up to the ability to work with certain people as part of your ethnographic fieldwork for the book, but also the fieldwork itself. So I would love, if you wouldn't mind, if I could ask you about just a couple of aspects of that.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So I have to ask, you know, everyone probably asks you this when, in the book, and this is the hosting the Chinese TV show, right?
Right, right.
Several times in the book, you mentioned an experience as the host of a Chinese TV show, and I think this was, if I'm reading correctly, 2003, 2004?
Right. Right at the beginning of 2003 was when I started and it carried over into 2004.
That's right. So can you talk about that a little bit? How specifically, I'm sure you could talk about that itself for several hours, but how did your experience doing that actually shape the project? Sort of did that have any meaningful or substantial effect on either the kind of research you were able to do for the project and or the way you thought about the project and your research trajectory and the kind of narrative that you wanted to provide?
Yeah, it had a profound effect. And I didn't even realize it until many years after the fact, really when I was writing the dissertation and then revising the book, how much an impact that experience had on not just making connections for my research, but really how I thought about, you know, some of the, even theoretically frame some of the aspects of the book. So, and let me first begin by saying that, you know, it sounds quite glamorous, but this was about the least glamorous TV show one can imagine. I mean, in reality, it was a kind of glorified infomercial. So the framing of this show was a foreigner looks at Chinese culture, but the sort of an example of a typical show would be that I'd say today we're going to learn about Chinese tea culture, and we would go profile a tea shop that was paying us to profile them. And it was, you know, and so the show was a very not so subtle advertisement for this particular tea shop. And we did the same thing with real estate, with Chinese restaurants, all sorts of things. And, you know, it was not glamorous at all. And in fact, the show that aired before ours was an infomercial for a hospital that specialized in like kidney disorders, I think. So, But it proved, from the very beginning of this project, I was faced with a challenge of, how do I make contacts for my research? That I'm not studying a kind of, a particular geographical community or neighborhood. The New Rich are scattered about this city of, 7 million people. How do I meet them? And I sort of, through various contacts, I was able to meet a few people here or there. I was able to do, I did some translation work for a couple business people, and that got me a few contacts. But really, it was ultimately the show where we were constantly profiling these businesses, and I was meeting the entrepreneurs who owned these businesses, that I was able to develop this kind of core network of entrepreneurs in Chengdu who became kind of the core group that I did my research with in the subsequent years.
Now, the nature of that research is actually also fascinating. So you describe, in the course of your research for the books, having to spend, as part of your ethnographic fieldwork, lots and lots and lots of afternoons and evenings with businessmen who were entertaining clients, partners, and state officials. Most of the fieldwork, at least it seems from my perspective as one reader of the book, from what I gathered, a lot of the fieldwork consisted of informal conversations in these kinds of contexts. Mm-hmm. So one can imagine that this would provide a lot of challenges for you as an ethnographer, both, physically, I can imagine,
right.
but also in other ways. So can you talk a little bit about that? What was that like for you? What were some of the challenges of doing ethnography in that way? And are there any particular experiences that you encountered in the course of this fieldwork that stand out as being especially notable for you and that you'd want to talk about?
Well, maybe if I can begin this question by kind of answering the second part of your last question. I mean, one other experience I had at the TV show was, even though my official title was co-host, in reality, what I spend most of my time doing was the kind of, courting and wining and dining our clients and potential clients. And it was through that, having to actually do that kind of courtship is what sort of, I think that having to participate in that myself is what sort of led me to focus on that aspect of being an entrepreneur in China when I started to do sort of full-time field work after I ended, my time with the TV show. So, and I think it was also that experience of the TV show that got me a sense of what being an entrepreneur in Chengdu in particular is often about, going to tea houses in the afternoon and playing cards with, potential clients or government officials, and then going to a banquet and then going out to karaoke. And I sort of, knew that would be the proper kind of venues and sites to conduct ethnography in. And it was challenging. I mean, one of the challenges is, how not to be, to sort of know when to switch from a sort of, a kind of casual conversational mode to a more formal interview register. So there were lots of really important, kind of conversations or key moments when, I didn't have my notebook out, or I wasn't really in kind of full ethnographer mode. And I, because of that, I sort of missed out on some important things. Another challenge was that there were certain activities that these, my informants participated in which I either was unwilling or unable to. I mean, one of the primary ones was just gambling. There's a lot of playing mahjong with your, or various card games with your business associates is a really important part of maintaining those business relationships. And, A, I didn't have the mahjong skill, and B, I didn't have the money to participate in that. And so, sitting around for, 3 or 4 hours or sometimes longer while people play mahjong is not a very, enjoyable way to spend an afternoon. And another thing that I learned through my experience courting our clients in the TV show was sort of banquet etiquette and ritual. One of the producers of the show was a very good teacher for that. And so this gave me a real advantage when I started to sort of venture off on my own conducting fieldwork, in that I was already fairly skilled in kind of the art of Chinese banquets and how to drink and the proper way to make a toast. And this, I think, made a real impression on some of the entrepreneurs that I was, you know, hoping to kind of court for my research. And so my function with them, you know, sort of evolved into that of, you know, I was basically an accessory or a, you know, what they call in Chinese a peijiu yuan, like literally a, you know, a professional accompanier for drinking at these banquets. And so, and that was really, you know, as anthropologists, we sort of strive to figure out, you know, we would like to make our field work a reciprocal exchange. So what can we give back to the people that we're studying? And ultimately my solution, you know, what I gave back to the new rich business people I was doing my fieldwork with was I helped them out in this, you know, what for them is often a very kind of tedious and unenjoyable task of, you know, banqueting and entertaining all their clients and government officials and various business partners. So I became a sort of accessory in that entertaining. And they would call me up and say, well, I've got an important official that I'm having dinner with tonight. You've got to come help me. And, you know, and I would do my duty and, you know, show up at the banquet.
I mean, I won't ask you to go into this, and I won't phrase this as a question, but I can imagine in this kind of an ethnographic situation, especially given the kinds of sorts of leisure activities that were involved in building these relationships that you discuss in the book, and we'll get to that in just a few minutes, or maybe a little bit more than that. I can imagine that this kind of ethnographic fieldwork involves occasionally dealing with some uncomfortable situations. And the book that resulted was fabulous. And so whatever ethnographic complications that must have arisen for you, I can't imagine spending years doing that and not, you know, coming into contact with situations that were difficult. Whatever you did to get through that, it's great, because the book itself really offers a picture of the kinds of, as you call them, I think, organized leisure or ritualized leisure without being judgmental.
Right.
So that's a really, really difficult balance, especially given these kinds of topics to strike. And I think you did it really beautifully here.
Well, thanks. It was difficult. I mean, having to sort of witness and to some extent, you know, maybe not fully participate, but at the very least observe, you know, practices and activities and that I really, you know, on a personal level found, you know, ethically and morally troublesome, and having to kind of distance myself from those without being viewed as kind of passing judgment on my informants was often really tricky. And, you know, my kind of go-to solution was just to play up my foreignness and say, you know, well, as an American, you know, or as a foreigner, you know, we don't do this or we don't do that or something like that. And that, once I got to know people, that was usually a acceptable explanation. So to kind of feel I should probably feel guilty as an anthropologist sort of playing up, you know, centralized cultural differences, but they served me well in getting out of tricky ethical situations.
So the kind of fieldwork we're talking about took place in Chengdu, and you're very careful in the book about being very specific that this is a local study of Chengdu. But at the same time, a lot of the, I think, conclusions and arguments that you're making can can extend beyond the particular case study of Chengdu as a regional site and to a more national context, and they have more national implications. So we can talk about that over the course of talking about the individual chapters as well.
Okay.
I'm sorry, go on.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, please.
I just am agreeing with, you know, your framing of it. I mean, that's exactly what I would say. I mean, there's definitely an aspect, you know, a kind of leisure is at the forefront of Chengdu life in a way that you might not find in other Chinese cities. So, you know, business that might be conducted in a, you know, in a boardroom in somewhere in Shanghai might be conducted in a tea house in Chengdu. But I think the sorts of networks I describe, the role, you know, some of the entertaining and courtship practices, you know, and the gendered nature of these networks, I think is something that definitely you'd find in, you know, most other Chinese cities.
And this gendered nature of this work is really important. And so the book really focuses on the transformation of networks of elite, let's say, business making, elite network making from the reform era in terms of masculinization. Mm-hmm. You're looking very carefully at the masculinization of private business and of deal making in China. And that has ramifications as well for women who were involved in this process. And we'll talk about that over the course of the conversation, both women entrepreneurs, but also women who are involved in this kind of gray area or this sort of pleasure, beauty?
Beauty, right.
Exactly. So we'll talk about that as well. So this is about masculinization, but women are mm-hmm. a really important part of the story of masculinization mm-hmm. and are also dealing with that as well. Other aspects of this kind of shifting morality that you are talking about in the book include the emergence of new cultural, social, and political forms, including new forms of leisure, new forms of consumption, new forms or new patterns of marriage and ways of practicing sexuality. You also mm-hmm. talk, and we'll get to this by the end of the conversation, about the nature of official corruption, sort of how to understand corruption more flexibly as part of this kind of interlocking civil and state set of relationships rather than something that's external to it or something that's sort of outside of these networks and an individual problem.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, really interesting. You're looking at the interlocking relationships of all of these factors, and you're doing this in a number of different ways. So let's start getting into the chapters and looking at the different kinds of arguments that you're making in the context of exploring these different aspects of the book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. So a lot of the story that you're telling us in the book focuses on the importance of social networks or guanxiwang.
Mm-hmm.
This has, of course, been a popular topic among lots of scholars of China, and you invoke a lot of the really important, relevant literature in the book so that we can understand the context that you're working in.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're doing here with Guanxi is actually importantly different from some of the prevailing literature on this. So because this seems to me to be one of the important contributions that you're making with the book, can you talk a little bit about some of the ways that your research and findings about Guanxi networks differ or your conclusions differ from other major work on Guanxi and Guanxi networks in China? So how are your findings about Guanxi networks importantly different from what we would read elsewhere?
Okay, well, I think for me, the key contribution that I'm trying to make in the book is to sort of look at Guanxi as a gendered phenomenon. And this is, you know, something that other scholars have explored a bit in the past. But I really put gender and Guanxi, I want to see in particular these sort of Guanxi networks in business as a gendered phenomenon. And I really see that as sort of my key intervention in the literature. And in many ways, you know, my argument sort of turns argument made by Mayfair Yang in her seminal Gifts, Favors, and Banquets on its head, where she saw kind of Guanxi as an implicitly feminine social formation against this sort of implicitly masculine, legal, rationalist state. And whereas I argued, in fact, that the kind of Guanxi, at least as it's emerged as this formation in, you know, among the elite in the business world in China is best understood as a sort of masculine form in which women can participate, but often at a cost to their reputations, which is something that, you know, I talk about in chapter 5, and we can talk about later. And this, you know, this idea just came from, you know, going out night after night with these business people and seeing that, you know, at the end of the evening, what was often left was, you know, even though the banquet may include women, but at the end of the evening, there were a group of men drinking, you know, in the private room of a karaoke club, often accompanied by female hostesses. And, you know, and that these were the kinds of relationships formed in these settings were really crucial to, you know, to their business success. So I think, you know, that's probably my key intervention in this literature.
Now, in fact, after the first chapter, which gives us a lot of this historical and theoretical background and talks in depth about a lot of the kind of broader phenomena that we've really just touched the surface of in the conversation, chapter two actually takes us into the texture of the practice of at least one set of spaces for the production of these networks. So you're looking in this chapter at the formation of these elite networks through spaces of ritualized leisure and entertainment that include private banquet rooms, they include saunas, massage parlors, and especially KTV clubs or karaoke clubs. This part of the book is arguing that the goal of business entertaining in the spaces, and this is really something that very, you make the point very clearly that this is very much about business, although at the same time, participants in these networks have a hard time separating sort of play from work, and this is not just, you know, guys chilling out and relaxing, right? It's like the But that part of what's happening in these spaces is a transformation of relationships from what you call interested, calculated, commodified relationships into the kinds of relationships that are rooted instead in, you know, what we might call irrational sentiment affect. And this is really the basis for the production of these business networks in China, or particularly in Chengdu here. So can you talk about this? Why are KTV clubs so important? What's the scene there? What can you expect in a typical night there? And how can you talk a little bit about the importance of this transformation of relationships that happens?
Sure. So this is, I mean, this is something that's a bit kind of counterintuitive to people. I mean, you have a lot of scholars and a lot of observers of China who basically see these kind of relationships between between entrepreneurs and government officials as more or less a kind of completely instrumentalized, completely calculating, as largely governed by interest and money. So, you know, in some accounts, this is sort of simply about bribery, about, you know, entrepreneurs bribing government officials for, you know, for contracts or for state support or that sort of thing. And what probably the most interesting thing that I found by spending so much time in these settings is that what entrepreneurs emphasize to me over and over again is that that bribery is never enough in these relationships, that anyone can give a bribe. And so it's precisely because anyone can give a bribe that this entertaining becomes all the more important, right? So I understand this entertaining as an attempt to kind of create some kind of experience or emotion or, you know, bond that's not going to be subject to commodification, right? That's resistance to just being, you know, that. So an official. So the idea is that these bonds between entrepreneurs and other entrepreneurs, or between entrepreneurs and government officials, are rooted in something that's not going to that's rooted in something like sentiment that's not going to be commodifiable, that's not going to dissolve when another person comes along and offers more money. So I understand entertaining then as an attempt to kind of create some sort of non-commodifiable or, you know, sentimental attachment in these relationships.
So, and that's actually an important point that runs through another aspect of this part of the book, in which even though you're arguing here, and I think very persuasively, that sexual entertainment is a really important form of business entertainment, at the same time, commodified sex in some way, so commercial sex, actually doesn't increase a man's status in this context, right? Because there's an absence of this sentiment. I mean, it seems to parallel the kind of phenomenon you're talking about.
Right. And I think, I mean, that exactly. And, you know, the broader context is that most of my informants and, you know, many ordinary Chinese kind of understand contemporary Chinese society as a place in which people's loyalties are sort of, you know, are for sale in some sense, in which increasingly interpersonal relationships are commodified, are governed solely by self-interest. So in this context, and this is the key point I'm making, if you can develop or cultivate relationships which are rooted in something else besides interest and simply, you know, and money, which are non-commodifiable, you're not only at a kind of advantage professionally from the perspective of business, but it's also a way of claiming a kind of elite status and distinction. So it was very important, for example, for these male businessmen to emphasize to me that their relationships with girlfriends or mistresses were not about money. She's interested in me because I'm a, charismatic and handsome businessman, not because I'm buying her gifts and that sort of thing. So it's this distancing from commodification that you find this both in these elite men's relationships with their friends and lovers, but also even in their business relationships, this kind of denial of being interested, of being in it for the money. This is not to say that people weren't interested in calculating. They were all the time, but this was all couched in a rhetoric of often, of affect, of friendship, of helping people out. They would even very common phenomenon, for example, was for these businessmen to refer to their patrons, either in the government or other more connected and powerful businessmen, as their big brothers, to sort of speak of these relationships in the language of kinship.
And young women actually play a really crucial role here too. And you discuss in this part of the book the ways that by playing roles as hostesses and as mistresses, they're actually projecting an idealized masculinity. So again, bringing the importance of this gendered aspect of these networks onto the men that they accompany. And it's really important here that they're doing this by choice, or that they are perceived to be, right, doing this,
right,
by choice.
Right, exactly. So there's, one of the other arguments I'm making about this entertaining, other than sort of creating these, quote unquote, irrational bonds that are sort of crucial for their business success. The other thing that's happening through this entertaining is they're sort of constructing a particular kind of elite masculinity. And as you point out, young women play a key role in this process. And it's very important that these, even though many of these young women are being paid, that they, again, that their interest in these men appear to be genuine and authentic rather than simply, paid for. And it's understood that, only kind of authentic interest and attention from young, attractive women can confirm one's masculinity can confirm one's status as a kind of elite subject.
Now, as we move from this into the next part of the book, you give us in chapter 3 examples of how some of these elite networks that are introduced earlier in the book play out in three different kinds of settings, but that are all related, and some of which are interrelated. You start off this part of the book by talking about something that I think is really, really interesting here and really changed the way I thought about this in the context of Chinese history, and that's the problem of corruption. So, I would love if you could talk a little bit about that, because you're offering at least what I as a reader see as a kind of corrective to how we usually think of corruption in the context of state and civil society and relationships here. You're kind of urging us, at least, again, this is what I got out of it, to think about corruption as something that's rooted in relationships, that's rooted in strategy and alliances. It's not really about one person. It's about networks, which have actually their own form of morality. So can you talk about that? Because I think it's really interesting, and it's related to, or as in part of this discussion in the book, you also relate this to trying to break away from some idea of an ahistorical and gendered human nature, which is related to this. And I think this is interesting and important to talk about, because this is really kind of the opposite of what a lot of people get in their, first or second year Chinese culture classes, where so much of the emphasis is on human nature and how did Chinese philosophers talk about human nature. You're really kind of interestingly complicating and historicizing this in the context of what may seem to be an unproblematic concept for people, corruption, and showing the very richness and complication of this. So that's a lot I'm throwing at you. Can you just talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think, the easiest way to sort of summarize it is, this idea came from, people that I talked to during the course of my research. And what what I kept hearing over and over again was people would say, well, even if you have an official who wants to be, who doesn't want to be corrupt, won't be able to survive as an official if he doesn't engage in some kind of corrupt practices, that there's this incredible pressure, this kind of informal social pressure to use his official position to the advantage of people in his social network. So it's not, you know, then this seems to complicate how certain, you know, certain strain of political science often thinks about corruption as really being about kind of an individual encountering a particular sort of structure or incentive structure often, and whether, you know, particular political institutions are set up in such a way that individuals might be incentivized to be corrupt. And I realized that we need to think about corruption in China, we need to see it as a product not of so much of an individual's calculation, but as this broader kind of social phenomenon, and in particular as really a direct product of the kinds of what I've referred to in my book as elite networks, of these networks that sort of straddle state and society, that are often composed of, you know, of both government officials, businessmen, and in some instances, you know, what we might think of as a kind of criminal underworld types. And that those networks kind of have their own rules, logics, their own moral economy, if you will. And often so that, you know, corruption was often about individuals kind of, or government officials in this instance, serving those networks and trying to, you know, to provide, you know, make sure that, for example, an entrepreneur that he's well connected with gets a government contract or something like that. And so, I mean, I think that's really the key point that I'm trying to make, to see this as that corruption as not just about an individual encountering an institution, but about these kind of broader networks that, you know, that extend beyond the state. And in some instances, you know, the impetus for corruption is not necessarily coming from, you know, a greedy official, but from, you know, relatives or friends who might be asking that official for favors to use his or her position, you know, to their advantage, and, you know, constant demands. This is something I saw witnessed firsthand, or the constant demands that that officials, or constant requests for favors that officials get from all sorts of people, you know, that people are literally almost lining up at their door to ask for special favors and treatment. And, you know, to refuse them all is from a kind of perspective of interpersonal morality, perhaps seen as, you know, immoral.
Someone needs to do an ethnography of the life of a university dean, I think. I'm sure some of these issues are not unrelated.
Just if I can add one thing, I mean, to tie it sort of back to masculinity, I mean, there's this sort of, this sort of elite masculine persona that I saw, you know, mimicked among government officials, business people, even, you know, college deans, of being someone who's well connected, who's able to, in a sense, transcend the rules, who's able to distribute various, you know, favors and benefits to people in his social network. And so to be unable to do that, to say, well, my hands are tied, I'm bound by the rules, is to really, you know, from the perspective of these men, is to kind of be embarrassed, is to sort of be emasculated, you know, to not be able to kind of partake in that sort of generous patron type, you know, mode, I think is often sort of, you know, I think that more than anything is the mark of being, you know, an elite man of status in China, to say, okay, your friend needs a job, let me make a phone call, you know, I can make it happen. Oh, you know, your friend's having trouble with, you know, getting a permit for something. Oh, that's no problem, I can take care of it. You know, to be able to have that sort of command, is something that I saw lots of men, even when they didn't have it, they would often pretend that they did, you know. And I saw that more than anything as sort of the marker of elite status among men in China.
Now, the chapter goes on to give us three in-depth, more than snapshots, I think, of cases in which these networks play out in different ways, and the individuals who you follow, who are really at the center or at least part of these networks, are dealing with the kinds of pressures and different kinds of demands placed on them that's involved in this process. So you look at actually the published confessional narrative of a corrupt official, Li Zhen, who's mm-hmm. really concerned with, and there's an interesting discussion in this part of the chapter of the economy of face. Mm-hmm. As an important component of a government official's power. You also look at the career of a real estate entrepreneur, which is really interesting. And of course, the middle one is one that, you know, I can't not ask you about, for which is Brother Fatty. And in the context of a sworn criminal brotherhood. And you describe the part of the fieldwork in your ethnography of Brother Fatty as being bored a lot of the time. And I just love that contrast. You know, we think of criminal brotherhoods, you're being bored all the time. I think that's great. This part of the chapter actually argues that criminal brotherhoods are not really, that we might understand them not as hostile threats to the state, but instead as providing revenue and forms of government, or governance rather, to the state. So did you want to say anything about that? Because I think this is, again, one of many parts of this book that really upends what we think about when we think about some of these concepts, like, you know, criminal brotherhoods, for example.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, this is probably also maybe not a departure from Chinese history. I mean, the ways in which sort of legitimate institutions and illegitimate institutions, you know, can kind of overlap, I think. I mean, you certainly find that during the Republican era in China. And that was, you know, immediately what was surprising to me, you know, when I got to know this guy who I call Brother Fatty, who's, you know, at first I didn't realize he was, you know, I thought he was, you know, more or less kind of a legitimate entrepreneur. And then, you know, when the first time he held court for, you know, 50 of his subordinates who referred to him as Big Brother and bowed to him and, you know, toasted him, I realized something else was going on. But, you know, also at these, at one of my early dinners with Brother Fatty, I mean, there were several police officers there who made no attempt, you know, who obviously knew who he was and made no attempt to hide their status. And this, and he would refer to his relation, you know, that he was constantly meeting with them, kind of discussing what was permissible and not permissible in his activities. And it seems so different from how we think about, you know, the relationship between, you know, the police and the criminal world in the U.S. And I think ultimately, you know, they are able to, and, you know, the state is able to kind of regulate the underground economy through some of these people like Fatty, who ensure that, you know, that criminal activities are controlled, that they're not too visible, they don't get too out of hand. And I also argue that they kind of manage this, you know, potentially unruly population of often, you know, not particularly well-educated bachelors, you know, from the countryside to come into the cities who are the ones who are the primary participants in the underground economy. And, you know, this ties in just to with the point I made, the kind of concept I introduced earlier of the informal network, you know, the elite informal network in China, where you have this, you know, often through social ties that are formed through banqueting and other entertaining practices, you often have, you know, government officials who are connected with members of the underworld, or businessmen who are connected with government officials and as well as members of the underworld. So you see this kind of these networks which are able to permeate multiple domains, you know, both state and civil society, both kind of, you know, the legitimate, quote unquote, legitimate world of business and this kind of underworld, underground economy.
Thank you. So as we move into the last parts of the book, We move into a discussion here in Chapter 4 on a discussion of consumption. So Chapter 4 looks at the ways that these elite networks that you've been describing, giving us such an interesting fleshed out picture of, have transformed patterns of consumption in urban China. And I won't ask you to talk too much about this, but I'll just mention for scholars of consumption, for people who are particularly interested in those issues, this is interesting because you're drawing a distinction between this urban Chinese case and the dynamics of consumption as understood in the work of perhaps one of the most famous theorists of consumption, Bourdieu, who focuses instead on capitalism in the West. So you're suggesting here that we think not in terms of a Bourdieuian distinction, but rather of recognition of the importance of what you call the legibility of economic value over some notion of taste. Now, I'm sorry, did you want to...
Oh, yeah, no, I think, well, I mean, I'll just, if I can just jump in, I mean, sort of tied in some ways, it's a theory of, it's an attempt, you know, so in Bourdieu's theory, you have this this notion of capital and the convertibility of capital that's at the heart of it, that where, you know, people have money, then they transform it into cultural capital or, you know, social capital, that sort of thing. And what was really interesting when conducting my fieldwork was to see how often that failed, you know, that people had, you know, that the new rich were in some sense sort of complaining to me that, you know, well, I have money, but now people don't see me as a moral person or as a cultured person, you know? So in some ways I'm using my ethnographic material to kind of challenge the, you know, Bourdieu's model is incredibly powerful and definitely influenced my thinking, but I just wanted to complicate the notion that, you know, for, you know, transforming, you know, economic capital into other forms of capital is not as straightforward a process as perhaps Bourdieu's model might imply. And in particular, in the case of China, in which, you know, these social networks and the kind of the perceptions of one by other members of these networks are so important, this process can become even more fraught, and that people often describe themselves as sort of consuming for others, or being even having to buy things that they didn't necessarily like, just for the sake, simply for the sake of pleasing others, so I introduced this notion of recognition as an alternative to distinction, as a way of talking about how consumption in China is often about visibility, about being recognized as a particular kind of subject by others, rather than distinguishing oneself, from others, as we tend to think about it in the West.
Great. And this actually brings me to just another thing I wanted to mention about this chapter. And if you have any thoughts on this, please jump in as well, which is related to this. You make the point here that though many elites, this is related to what you were just saying, they're viewing autonomy and a kind of living for oneself as a marker of social capital, maybe social distinction, as a marker of their social status. At the same time, the practice of distancing oneself from these social circles to focus on these more solitary pursuits actually, you know, undermines the very networks that provided the foundation of the elite status and recognition in the first place. And so this is one of, I think as a reader, one of the really wonderful things about the book is that there's some kind of contradiction, at least one at the heart of every single one of the chapters that you're giving us, in which you're really urging us to think again about something we might take for granted. And this is this contradiction between the role of the individual as individual versus the role of the individual as part of one of these elite networks is really interesting. And you kind of see through this movement how this kind of tension of existence between these two poles produces these kinds of social forms and produces the person in some ways in these contexts. It's really interesting.
Well, thanks. I'm glad that came through. That's exactly the point that I was trying to make. And it was something that emerged in several interviews where, you know, I had this experience where some of my interviewees kind of in the course of talking to me and answering my questions sort of realized, you know, wait a minute, like it was, you know, I thought getting rich would allow me to kind of do whatever I wanted and to not have to bother, you know, courting people and, you know, wining and dining every night. But, you know, now I'm rich and I find myself kind of trapped by these social obligations. And in fact, I'm even more trapped than I was before, you know, and it's this, and it was a really kind of powerful kind of realization that many of my interviewees had in talking to me that I try to convey in the book, that this expectation of what being, you know, someone of who, you know, having a lot of wealth and status was going to be, and then the reality of it is to often be, you know, as they, many of them said, is to live, to have to live for others, you know, even though they're, you know, would have the means to kind of isolate themselves, to do so is to kind of, you know, to risk undermining the foundations of their sort of social recognition and status.
And one of the, before I move to the penultimate chapter, but I need to ask you about the women entrepreneurs, right? I also just wanted to mention for listeners that there's also a wonderful account in chapter 4 of fruit plates. And so I think if it's not already being done, someone needs to do either a photo essay or some sort of piece just on these fruit plates that are presented as gifts in these KTV clubs. I just think I wanted to see lots and lots. I now want to see lots and lots of fruit plates.
Yeah, well, it was one of the biggest regrets of my time in China that I didn't have my camera when I, you know, there's the fruit plate episode that I describe in the book where it really, I mean, it had to be seen to be believed. I mean, it was 5 feet long and, you know, 2 or 3 feet high. It was unlike, you know, it was fruit sculpture more than a fruit plate. I don't know if I mentioned this in the book. I mean, one of the great triumphs of my research in China was the day that I was presented with a fruit plate, which was just, you know, unlike the elaborate fruit sculpture that many of my VIP friends would receive. Mine was kind of, I think it was 2 slices of watermelon and maybe half of an orange, but it was still an important moment, as well as it was, you know, as I argue in the book, a kind of recognition of my status, you know, and a recognition that's not available to all people who frequent a club. So
as we move from the fruit plates to the beauty economy, chapter 5 looks at 2 different groups of women closely, women entrepreneurs, who we haven't yet been talking about, and mistresses of wealthy men. And you look in this chapter at what you call a beauty economy in reform China and you know, contemporary China. And also you look closely at female entrepreneurs, women entrepreneurs, and the particular challenges that they face in the context of these elite networks. So could you say a little bit about maybe first, what is the beauty economy, and talk a little bit about that. And then perhaps we can, before we conclude, we can say a little bit about women entrepreneurs and where they fit in this story.
Mm-hmm. Well, the term beauty economy, or in Chinese, 美女经济, wasn't coined by me. It's something that I think was coined by some Chinese journalists, and it was a term that I often heard my informants use. And basically, this refers to the use of, you know, young, attractive women in various sorts of commercial endeavors, you know, whether, you know, having, for example, it's at trade fairs, it's really common to hire like attractive female university students to hand out promotional material. I think more broadly, it just refers to the kind of commodification of women's femininity and sexuality that you find in post-Mao China. I mean, another closely related phrase is 吃青春饭, like eating the rice bowl of youth, or sometimes translated as eating spring rice, in which, you know, these various kinds of occupations in which young, attractive women are able to kind of cash in on their feminine capital. And there's I found very kind of starkly divided reactions to this phenomenon, where some people saw this as a kind of rational, totally understandable entrepreneurialism, that well, they have this capital, so why not cash it in? Whereas others really, you know, were very troubled by this and saw this as evidence of a kind of moral decline in post-Mao China. And the ubiquitousness of these practices, and, you know, where in which young women kind of cash in on their attractiveness and sexuality, posed a real problem for women entrepreneurs who were often accused of doing the same, you know, and it was very common, for, you know, for there to be, there's a lot of, you know, in my field work, a lot of people knew each other and they were often talking behind the backs of other people. And it was very common for friends and associates of women entrepreneurs I knew to say, well, you know, she really made her money by, you know, through men, more or less, you know, either accusing them of sleeping their way to the top or of having, you know, a former husband or lover who was an important individual, basically accusing them of, you know, cashing in on their femininity to get ahead. And so women entrepreneurs were often kind of at pains to distinguish themselves from women who they, you know, they viewed as participants in this beauty economy by arguing that their success was was really the product of their own hard work. And, you know, and in fact, pointing out very rightly so that they paid often a price to their reputations by participating in business, which, you know, by going to banquets and drinking with their clients and, you know, sometimes going out to KTVs were not really seen as the proper activities, you know, for a quote unquote, you know, Yang Jiafunyu, woman from a good home, you know, in urban China. So, and I ended up devoting this whole chapter to women entrepreneurs because I realized that they were in fact some of my best informants, you know, because they had been given their kind of marginalized perspective on business in China and on these sort of masculinized networks. I mean, they saw the sort of social field I was trying to describe very clearly. And, you know, I think one of the most surprising things was their kind of articulation of a sort of meritocratic individualist ideology as against men. You know, they, a really common theme from my interviews with them was that, well, you see all these successful men in China, but they've just relied upon, you know, their bros and their guanxi, and, you know, they actually don't have any talent or ability. Whereas women, because we can't rely upon these gendered networks, you know, of men in power, we have to kind of forge ahead on our own and only rely on ourselves and our own ability. And this was, you know, I think it was kind of surprising, you know, because given also in the West, our tendency to kind of associate individualism and meritocracy, you know, and as sort of an implicitly masculinist kind of sort of mode and discourse.
It's also really interesting to put it in those terms because, again, we have this really interesting contradiction where on the one hand, which again, I think comes up in every single one of the chapters. It's one of the really interesting things about reading the book is that in here, on the one hand, we have women entrepreneurs claiming that, you know, they did it on their own because, you know, they're kind of put in a position where they have to sort of claim that. And on the other hand, we've just been reading a book that looks at the importance of not doing it on your own, right? And not perceived of as doing it on your own in order to create the kind of power that emerges from these networks. So it's a really interesting, again, dynamic that you're giving us in that chapter.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a real discrepancy between one of the real challenges in writing the book is often kind of the practices that I observed were very different from, there's a real discrepancy between how people described what they were doing and what I sort of observed as a, you know, somewhat distant observer, and that people were, you know, were very careful about framing their own practices in a particular way to appear as moral or as properly elite or as not, you know, just a baofahu nouveau riche. But often some of the framing of their practices sometimes contradicted what they actually did or had to do. So it was, you know, sort of sorting that out. You know, I think one of the challenges of doing ethnographic research in China is that there's often such a discrepancy between a kind of front stage presentation of a particular phenomenon and then a sort of backstage, you know, actually, you know, the backstage, how it's actually happens in practice. And it's even more challenging because it's not as if one is more real than the, it's not as if what's going on backstage is the truth and the, you know, the front stage is a kind of false veneer, but there's often a kind of complex relationship between the two. And it's, you know, I think some researchers in China, they get all the backstage or they get all the front stage, but trying to move between those two levels, between, you know, kind of official public representations and then kind of practices behind the scenes can be really challenging.
So, John, we've taken up a huge amount of your time, and I'm already over time with you, but I want to just really mention one final thing before we come to the closing questions of the interview.
Sure.
There is a conclusion in the book, and it's a conclusion that does a lot of really interesting argumentative work and conceptual work that relates the kinds of arguments that you've been making and case studies that you've been bringing us into in the book to understanding a wider range of more contemporary problems or issues in understanding society in China right now. And so I'm not going to ask you to talk about that necessarily, but I just want to signal for listeners that you are bringing us out in this part of the book into issues of, or into sort of a way to take our understanding after having now made it through the five chapters of the book of the complicated networks of Guanxi particular and the factors that are involved in this, to bring that out into understanding how this plays out in terms of a wider social and public morality, how we understand things like faulty construction, what you call tofu dregs construction, and other wider social problems that this case study that's very focused can perhaps help us inform. So rather than asking you about one particular part of it that I pick out, before we come to the conclusion, is there anything in particular in that conclusion that you've given us in the book that you would like to talk about or mention, or that you would like to signal as particularly important to you as part of the argument that you're making with the book?
Well, I think I can probably summarize the conclusion in one sentence, which is more or less that the moral economy of these elite Guanxi networks results in very immoral consequences for the public good. And I see that as a sort of corrective to some claims that it's kind of that have viewed sort of Chinese society as sort of lacking in morality or being in a state of where people have no beliefs or no ideology. Because it seems like these social networks that I describe have an incredibly profound influence on people's, you know, sense of morality. But unfortunately, it hasn't resulted in a kind of public oriented morality. It's very much a sort of privatized morality of one's, you know, local social world that doesn't extend to others. But I already see, you know, in the book with what in fact will likely be my next research project. And quite literally the book ends with the last sentence, you know, leaves off where my next research project will likely begin, which is this kind of search for some sort of framework of belief or morality that I find among many new rich and new middle class in China. You know, that there, you know, I mentioned this in the book, a phrase that I heard over and over again in interviews was, Chinese people don't have beliefs anymore. No one believes in anything anymore. And many saw themselves as kind of actively searching for some sort of framework of belief. And in some instances, it was religion. You know, in some instances, it was philanthropy of some kind or doing some sort of charity work. But this kind of quest for a different kind of connection to others than these, you know, the constant give and take of their social circles, you know, that maybe they can forge a connection to, you know, to the society as a whole, you know, through philanthropy or through forms of religious belief and practice.
Well, John, thank you so much for letting me take so much of your time. It's such an interesting book, and I think the nature of the conversation and the fact that I've kept you so long is really testament to how interesting the book is on so many levels. Clearly, we didn't have a chance to get through even half of what we should have gotten through in the chapters. It's a very rich study. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Well, no, I think I've hit upon, you know, the key themes of the book. In fact, I mean, I want to thank you for your very well-informed questions, because in many ways you did a better job of summarizing my argument in the chapters than I might have done on my own. So I appreciate that. But I think, No, I don't think I would add anything at this point.
Well, you've already mentioned very briefly the next project on belief and morality among the new rich in China. Is that where you're heading next? Is that the what you're currently inspired by?
Yeah, I'm actually headed to China next week to sort of do some preliminary research for my next project. I mean, one aspect of this broader kind of quest for belief and meaning that I find particularly interesting is, and this is, you know, quite literally in the last paragraph of my book, is in Chengdu in particular, you find a lot of wealthy Han Chinese who become devotees of Tibetan Buddhism, you know, and specifically Tibetan Buddhism, not, you know, various kind of Han Chinese strains of Buddhism. So it's precisely, you know, the attraction of Tibetan Buddhism in many ways is that it represents in their minds everything that kind of contemporary urban Han Chinese society is not. You know, it's viewed as spiritual instead of materialistic. It's viewed as kind of pre-modern instead of modern. But it's interesting though, because their relationship to it, at least initially, is often mediated by money, you know, by giving big donations to temples or to particular, you know, reincarnated lamas. So I think there are a lot of, again, you've gathered from my book that I'm drawn to contradictions. There's some interesting contradictions in that practice. So that there's definitely, I think that may very well be, you know, my next research subject.
Well, best of luck with that research. Have a great time researching in China, and we'll look forward to talking with you again about that project.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your well-informed questions and for giving me the chance to talk about my book.
Of course. You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.